Shalom Hanavarniks. Welcome to Hanavar Messianic Ministries School of Biblical and Jewish Studies. We're studying the Jewish Life of the Messiah, the 2021 edition. And this is lesson 13, and we're in session 46. So let's go ahead and review session 45. Now in session 45, Yeshua and the disciples left the upper room on the western hill, and they traveled down into the Kidron Valley and over to the Garden of Gethsemane. There in the Garden of Gethsemane, Yeshua was suddenly great pressure fell upon Yeshua, and he was very distressed and troubled, so deeply grieved that he was to the point of death. And what this means is that he was so deeply grieved that his physical frame was on the verge of collapsing. And another evidence of that was the fact that his sweat became like drops of blood. But then an angel came and appeared to him and encouraged him. And the angel encouraged him with the program of Isaiah 49. Now, Isaiah 49, verses 1 through 4, the first part of the program is that Israel rejects the Messiah. The second part of the program is verses 5 through 7. That rejection opens up the messianic message to the Gentile world. And the third step, in verses 8 through 13, after a time, Israel returns as it's restored and regathered. So Yeshua is probably agonizing over the fact that he has completed his mission, but Israel has rejected him and the messianic kingdom. But the angel tells him, no, your mission isn't a failure. In fact, it's right on the program of God. This is exactly the program of God. It's being accomplished. But then there's another issue that he's agonizing over, and that is the cup. What is the cup? And there were a number of suggestions I shared with you. Some think it's his physical death. Well, he wasn't afraid of physical death. Secondly, some think it was a fear of dying prematurely. Well, there were plenty of options for that, and that didn't happen. And so that can't happen. Thirdly, some think he was afraid that the cup representing God's wrath was permanent and there'd be no resurrection. But that's impossible too, because resurrection is very much part of the scriptures and the prophets. So the fourth suggestion, and the one that really only fits the case, is that the cup represents the coming wrath of God. Yeshua is anticipating the onslaught, and believe me, that would not be pleasant. Anticipating the onslaught of the wrath of God. Then we learn that the Sanhedrin broke 21 of their traditional laws during the religious trials, and we ask the question, why did the Sanhedrin feel free to set aside the very traditions they held so dear? And we did some research into the Mishnah, and we discovered a principle derived from Yevamot 90b. And this is a Yevamot 90b. This is a legal precedent found in the Talmud. And we read in that Mishnah commentary, the Sanhedrin is allowed to act in extra legal ways on a temporary basis if there is a compelling reason to do so. In other words, you can set aside your legal protocol, your legal procedures temporarily if the reason is good enough. And the compelling reason was Yeshua, because this is the way the religious leaders thought of him. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will what? Will come and take away both our place and our nation. This is very compelling circumstances. We got to get rid of this guy. Then we looked at the chronological aspects of Judas's betrayal. He left the Passover Seder, and then he probably went to the location of the high chief priest, the home of the high chief priest. And they probably sent him to Pilate with a charge, a political charge. More than likely, the charge was something like, he claims to be king of the Jews. He's an insurrectionist against Caesar. Well, that would be sufficient charge for Pilate to release the cohort, 400 to 600 soldiers. And then Judas leads them back to Mark's house. That's the last place he saw Yeshua and the disciples. But Passover is now over. They've left. And so after questioning them in Mark's house, he now leads them to Gethsemane, with Mark trailing along behind. The arresting group consisted of Roman soldiers, a minimum of 400. The cohort was between 400 and 600 soldiers. Then servants of the high priest, Thirdly, other Jewish officers, and finally, the Sanhedrin members. So it's quite a group. And after coming, Judas immediately went to him, saying, "Rabbi," and kissed him. Now, kissing a rabbi is normally a sign of a disciple submitting himself to a rabbi, but Judas is defaming that which is holy in the Jewish world. Well, Peter responds by striking the high priest's slave, Malchus, and cutting off his right ear. And Yeshua immediately stops him. "Put away your knife. Those who live by the sword will die by the sword." And then he heals Malchus's ear. So he saved Peter's life right there. Well, this brings us to the new material. We're now in section 228, lesson 13, page 34, and we're at the first Jewish trial of three, the first Jewish phase. This is before Annas. Now, Annas served as high priest from 7 to 14 A.D. He was deposed by the Roman procurator Valerius Gratus. However, he maintained control of the priesthood. He was followed by four of his sons into the priesthood, and then he was followed by his son-in-law, Caiaphas, which happens to be the situation right now. After that, he was followed by his grandson. Now, Jewish law states that once you're the high priest, you hold that position for life until you die. However, he was deposed by the Roman procurator and replaced with his son-in-law, Caiaphas. That's why you'll read that both Annas and Caiaphas are referred to as the high priest. Annas was the high priest under Jewish law. Caiaphas was the high priest under Roman occupation. Now, Annas was also the head of the bazaar of the sons of Annas. We discussed that earlier. Twice Yeshua has come and overthrown the tables and the money changers, and that created animosity from Annas, and that's probably the reason for this first religious trial. So let's move on to the trial and its violations. This is page 35 at the top of the page. And the purpose for the trial is to try to establish a religious charge. We start with John 18:13. "And led him to Annas first, for he was father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year." So we're told they bring Yeshua after his arrest to trial for Annas, before Annas. So from the Garden of Gethsemane, they then move out, the arresting party moves out around the northern end of the Temple Mount or across the Temple Mount to what some commentators feel is the council chamber on the western side of the Temple Mount. Now, this is here is the area in modern times. This is the way it looks today, leaving Gethsemane, going around or through the Temple Mount, northern side of the Temple Mount, and then coming south and going to the council chamber. So that's a possibility. All right, now this is the fourth violation of Sanhedrin law. The Sanhedrin law stated that there would be no trials before the morning sacrifice, and yet it is in the middle of the night. Verse 14. "Now Caiaphas was one who had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people." Well, in verse 14, we see that this is also a kangaroo court. The verdict has already been determined. Yeshua was already under the death penalty. Now, we're going to skip down to verse 19 at this point. We'll pick up the comments regarding Peter when we get to section 230. So let's drop down to verse 19. "The high priest then questioned Yeshua about his disciples and about his teaching. So Annas inquires of Yeshua regarding two topics, two matters. First, concerning his disciples in order to incriminate them. And second, concerning his teachings to try to find a religious charge." Yeshua responds in verse 20. "Yeshua answered him, 'I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in the synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together, and I spoke nothing in secret.'" Yeshua reminds them of their own Mishnaic law, the trials being conducted in secret, contrary to the Mishnah's teaching. In contrast, the trial was to be done publicly in the temple in front of Jewish audiences. So this is a fifth law that is violated. Four have been violated. Four laws have been violated during the arrest. So the fifth law, there was to be no secret trials. This will also be true of the second and third stages of the religious trial. All right, verse 21. "Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said." When he had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Yeshua, saying, Is that the way you answer the high priest? And Yeshua answered him, If I have spoken wrongly, testify to the wrong. But if rightly, why do you strike me? So Yeshua refers them to their own law and challenges them to produce a charge. Then in verse 22, the Messiah is struck by one of the officers, and this is the first of several mistreatments Yeshua will suffer this night. And the result? No specific charge is found. The first stage ends in a failure. Verse 24. So Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. So we have a couple of maps here. Here they're in the council chamber. And if that's true, they have to leave the council chamber and go up onto the western hill. This is kind of ironic. Here's the way it looks today. The council chamber was thought to be somewhere over here and then up on to the western hill. Again, this is ironic because Caiaphas' house is built very close to where the Last Supper took place, the last Passover. It too is on the western hill. All right. We're now on Lesson 13, page 36, section 229, the second Jewish trial. This is before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. Now, Caiaphas served from 18 to 36 A.D. He was the son-in-law of Annas. So the trial is occurring halfway through his term of office in 30 A.D. All right, we'll pick it up in Matthew 26, 57. Those who had seized Yeshua led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and elders were gathered together. But Peter was following him at a distance, as far as the courtyard of the high priest, and entered in and sat down with the officers to see the outcome. So we're told the Sanhedrin was present in Caiaphas' house. So let's take a quick tour of Caiaphas' house. Now this is the Church of St. Peter of Gallicantu. Gallicantu, I believe it's Latin, and it translates into cockcrow. So church was erected on the site of Caiaphas' house because that's where Peter denied his Lord when the rooster crowed. So we won't look at the inside of the church itself. It's very beautiful and all that good stuff, but it's not original. We're going to go down into the basement of Caiaphas' house because that's all that's left of it. We're now in the basement. And down in the basement, there's huge storerooms hacked out of the rock. And these are huge storerooms to store all his wood or wheat or grapes or gold or silver or whatever he possessed. He was a very, very rich man, and these storerooms show how rich he was. He had lots of room there. Now, he also had a high-tech house because he had a cistern built into the house, and all you had to do was drop your bucket down this opening and you'd get fresh water for the house. Now, this cistern was probably dry in Yeshua's day because some think that Yeshua was held captive in the cistern for a few hours. And we're looking down at the cistern here, and here are some of my students and our guide explaining this cistern to them. That's possible that Yeshua was imprisoned here for a short time. Now, we're looking at Peter and Gallicantu from below. There's the church. We're looking at it from a different angle, the opposite angle of the first picture. But this is not the important aspect of the picture. The important aspect of this picture is the first century stairway in the bottom right corner. This is the first century stairway. It's been in existence since the first century, and you can bet your retirement that Yeshua walked up these steps when he was taken to Caiaphas' house. Here we're about halfway up the stairway, and now we're all the way up the stairway. Yeshua could have most likely walked these stairs. Now, on our right side, we see a courtyard. That's the courtyard of Caiaphas' house. This is the courtyard where Peter sat down to see what would happen. All right, the Sanhedrin is present at Caiaphas' house. Well, this is a violation of law number 6. Sanhedrin trials could only be conducted in the hall of judgment of the temple compound, not in Caiaphas' house. Now, the full Sanhedrin was made up of 24 chief priests, 24 elders, 22 scribes, and one high priest, for a total of 71. But for a capital trial, a minimum of 23 were needed. 11 votes were needed to acquit, 13 votes were needed to convict. Now, we're not told exactly how many were present, but it can't be all 71. a minimum of 23. The maximum that could have been there was 69, because we know for two for sure were not present, Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea. So when Mark and Matthew say all the Sanhedrin was present, apparently they're meaning all those necessary for the trial to be conducted. So let's take a look at the trial. We pick it up on verse 59. Now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Yeshua so they might put him to death. So they bring false witnesses first. This violates the seventh Sanhedrin law. The defense was supposed to go first, then the prosecution. And we're told the whole council that was present, everyone that was present, was seeking to convict. And this violates law number 8. Law 8 says that all may argue in favor of acquittal, but not all may argue in favor of guilt. And they're all arguing in favor of guilt here. Matthew 26:60. And they did not find any false witnesses, even though many false witnesses came forward. But later, two came forward. So this is violation of law number 9. There were to be two or three witnesses, and their testimony had to agree in every detail. This is based on Deuteronomy 19:15. A single witness shall not rise up against a man on account of any iniquity or any sin which he's committed. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed. So there's an inability to gain witnesses that agree in every detail. There must be at least two, and they must agree. Finally, two witnesses sound the same, but there are differences that disqualify them. Mark 14:58. We heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another made without hands. I will destroy. This statement is a threat. Mark's witness says that Yeshua made a threat against the temple. Matthew 26:61. And said, this man stated, I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. I am able. This statement is a boast. Matthew's witness said that Yeshua made a boast about his power, and he mentioned the temple. Now, Jewish law says this difference would disqualify the witnesses. Mark 14:59. Not even in this respect was their testimony consistent. And so the initial charge, disrespect for the temple, doesn't work. The two witnesses that are somewhat close in their comments are too far apart for that to be valid. All right, Matthew 26:62. The high priest stood up and said to him, do you not answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you? So Yeshua is ordered to respond. Caiaphas demands that Yeshua respond, but there's no need. He maintains his legal rights under the Mishnah to be quiet. And this is violation number 10. There was to be no allowance for the accused to testify against himself. And yet, that's what Caiaphas is ordering him to do. Verse 63. But Yeshua kept silent, and the high priest said to him, I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Messiah, the Son of God. So now he puts Yeshua under oath. And the demands of him, are you the Son of God? Are you the Messiah? And this tells us two things. First of all, Caiaphas knows Yeshua's claims, and he also recognizes who Yeshua is supposed to be. He's supposed to be the Son of God. The answer is in verse 64. Yeshua said to him, you have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. You have said, it's an idiom close to our English idiom meaning yes. You know, you said it. The idea is yes. And then that term Son of Man, that's a messianic title based on Daniel 7:13. So Yeshua claims to be the Messiah, and he verifies that claim when he says next time they see him, it'll be in his glorious second coming. So Yeshua is being crystal clear here. Oh, you better believe I'm the Messiah. Verse 65. Then the high priest tore his robes. This violates the 11th commandment. The high priest was forbidden to tear his robes. Second part of the verse. And said, he has blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, you have now heard the blasphemy. And this violates law number 12. Charges could not originate with judges. They could only investigate charges brought to them. And yet Caiaphas here is charging Yeshua with blasphemy. And again, this violates the requirement of two witnesses that agree. The accusation is being brought without witnesses. Now remember, the Sanhedrin members are judges. They are not witnesses. So the charges cannot originate with them. And the charge of blasphemy violates law number 13. The accusation of blasphemy was only valid if he pronounced the name of God itself, Yahweh. And he does not pronounce God's personal name at any point during this trial. Verse 66. What do you think? They answered, he deserves death. Now this violates law number 14. A person could not be condemned on the basis of his own words alone. This also violates law number 15. The verdict cannot be announced at night, only in the daytime. And this violates law 16. In cases of capital punishment, the trial and the verdict cannot occur at the same time, but must be separated by at least 24 hours. Had they followed this Mishnaic law, the verdict would have been pronounced during the feast, something they absolutely did not want. The masses would find out, and it could cause a riot. And this also violates law number 17. Voting for the death penalty was to be done by individual count, 1, 2, 3, 4, beginning with the youngest, so that the young would not be influenced by the elders, and yet this vote is done by all present, by voice acclamation. Everybody says, hang him. He deserves death. Crucify him. And this also violates law number 18. And that law states that a unanimous decision for guilt proves innocence. So everybody present condemned him to death. By their own law, he should now be released. By the way, we're on page 39 of your outline. You see, a unanimous vote for guilt shows innocence. Why? Because it's impossible for between 23 to 71 people to agree without plotting. You know our old Jewish saying, you get two Jews together, you get three opinions. That's the case here. So a unanimous vote implies collusion, plotting. And plotting it was, collusion it was. And this also violates law number 19. The sentence can only be pronounced 3 days after the verdict. So they pronounced the death sentence on the same night. It was supposed to be announced 3 days later. Again, this would have come during the feast, absolutely something they did not want. They didn't want the verdict or the sentence announced during the feast. Matthew 26:67. Then they spat in his face and beat him with their fists, and others slapped him and said, prophesy to us, you Messiah. Who is the one who hit you? This violates law number 20. Sanhedrin laws say judges are to be humane and kind. Now, hardly being humane and kind here. And this violates law number 21. A person condemned to death cannot be beaten or scourged beforehand. So 21 specific laws have been broken. The very thing they have against Yeshua, they now have against themselves 21 times over. Now, Matthew says that they beat him with a fist, slapped him with the hand, and spit on him. These three are considered the highest indignities under Jewish law, and they are punishable to a greater or lesser degree. All right, let's look at these cultural indignities and their punishment. If you struck somebody with a fist, you would be fined 4 denarii. 4 days' wages for punching a guy. Pretty strict. If you slapped him with the palm of your hand, you would be fined 200 denarii, 200 days' wages. That's 2/3 of your yearly income. And finally, the worst one is if you spit in his face, then you were fined 400 denarii, 400 days' wages. You were fined more than 1 year's salary. Pretty stiff sentences. Pretty serious offenses. And of course, these judges aren't going to fine themselves. They're just going to let that go by. Now, moving toward the third stage of the religious trial, we see that Yeshua has been condemned on the ground of blasphemy, and they have broken 21 of their own laws. So now go to page 40. Go to page 40 in your outline. And we come to a little irony here. The irony? We have found the tomb of Caiaphas, or probably found the tomb of Caiaphas. All right. We found the bones of the high priest who condemned Yeshua. On page 40 of your outline, there's a reproduction from Biblical Archaeology Review that carried this article, the tomb of Caiaphas. So archaeologists found a burial chamber and a very, very, very ornate bone box. There's the bone box in its little niche there. What's a bone box? A bone box is called an ossuary. Now, in Jewish burial systems, you would have a burial cave. And when one member died, he would be placed in the cave and wrapped up in linen. And then the body, the flesh of the body, would rot away, would decay away. After about a year, the bones would be removed in the burial niche, from the burial niche, and placed in an ossuary, in the bone box, the bone storage box. Well, a short time went by, and the next person died. They were placed in the niche. The same thing happened, and their bones were put into an ossuary, a bone storage box as well. And so the grave was reused over and over and over. And when the bone box got filled up, you'd just get another one and fill it up. Now, here's what the caption reads on that photograph. Fit for a high priest. The most intricately carved ossuary in the burial chamber lay undisturbed in niche 4, decorated with two circles, each containing 5 whorl rosettes surrounding by a center rosette. The ossuary twice bears, with a slight variation, spelling the name Yehosef Bar Kaffa, Joseph, son of Caiaphas. Inside the ossuary, there are the remains of 6 people, 2 infants, a child between the ages of 2 and 5, a youth aged 13 to 18, an adult female, and a man about 60 years old. Given the name inscribed on the ossuary, together with the extravagance of its decoration, the excavators wondered whether the remains of the 60-year-old man might well be those of the high priest described in the New Testament as interrogating Yeshua and then delivering him to the Roman authorities. And here's some photographs of that incredible ossuary. Notice that magnificent decoration on the side of it. That is a piece of stonework. It's an extravagantly decorated ossuary. It must have been by an extravagantly rich family. That clicks, doesn't it? Here's a 3/4 view of the ossuary of Caiaphas. And here is one of those inscriptions on the side. And here's a close-up of that inscription. And it reads, Yehosef Bar Kaffa, Joseph, the son of Caiaphas. So very possibly, these are the bones of Caiaphas. And by the way, this very, very incredibly ornate box is in the Israel Museum today. So when you go to Israel, be sure you go to the Israel Museum. But the neat thing, folks, is that they're never going to find the bones of Yeshua anywhere. No way. We may have found the bones of his persecutor, but you're not going to find the bones of Yeshua. He's been resurrected. Well, can we prove that these are the remains of Caiaphas? Well, no, we can't. We can't. But at the very least, this find is independent attestation, independent evidence of the truth of the account. Caiaphas was a real man, a real person, just as Yeshua walked this earth in reality and in truth. All right, lesson 13, page 41. We're in section 230, Peter's denials. And we start with the location. In the upper room discourse, Yeshua prophesied that Peter would deny him 3 times. Unwittingly, John sets the stage for Peter to do just that. After the arrest, we're told in section 228, verse John 18:15, Simon Peter was following Yeshua, and so was another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest and entered with Yeshua into the court of the high priest. So John and Peter follow Yeshua at a distance, and they follow him right into the very courtyard of the high priest Caiaphas. Now John gets in because he's known to the high priest. John knows the name of the high priest's servant as well, Malchus. Peter cut off his ear. So the family of John and the family of the high priest are on friendly terms. Now the servant girl recognized John and allowed him in verse 16. But Peter was standing at the door outside. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the doorkeeper and brought Peter in. So John arranges for Peter to come into the courtyard. John is not doing Peter a favor. He brought him into circumstances which would lead to Peter denying Yeshua three times. So let's look at the denials. First of all, he's accused of being a disciple of Yeshua. Verse 17. Then the slave girl who kept the door said to Peter, "You are not also one of this man's disciples, are you?" And he said, "I am not." So here's Peter cringing before the slave girl. "I am not. I am not." So he simply denies it. It's very simple. He simply denies the truth. Verse 18. Now the slaves and the other officers were standing there having made a charcoal fire, for it was cold and they were warming themselves. And Peter was also with them, standing and warming himself. So here's the courtyard where they were. They were in this courtyard. Peter's now by the fireplace there. Let's take a look at the parallel account of the first denial. Matthew 26:69-70. Now Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him and said, "You too were with Jesus the Galilean." But he denied it before them all, saying, "I don't know what you're talking about." Now, back in the upper room, Yeshua said in Mark 14:30, and Yeshua said to Peter, "Truly I say to you that this very night, before a rooster crows twice, you yourself will deny me three times." So apparently the rooster crowed right about this time. This is implied. It is not stated. But apparently this was the first cock crow, the first time the rooster let forth his cock-a-doodle-doo. All right, let's move to Matthew 26:71. And when he had gone out to the gateway, another servant girl saw him and said to those who were there, "This man was with Jesus of Nazareth." So he's accused a second time. And his response is in verse 72. And again, he denied it with an oath. "I do not know the man." So he denies with an oath. So his denial progresses from a simple denial to a denial with an oath. Now, we're not talking about profanity here. Peter is calling on something sacred to guarantee the statement that his statement is true. He said something like this: "By heaven above, I don't know the man." Or, "By the altar in the temple, I don't know the man." You know, he's trying to be emphatic, trying to prove that his statement is true. Verse 73. A little later, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, "Surely you too are one of them, for even the way you talk gives you away." Then he began to curse and to swear, "I do not know the man." And immediately a rooster crowed. We're now on page 42. So Peter is accused a third time, and the progression continues and just gets worse. First it was a simple denial, then a denial with an oath. Now it's a denial with cursing and swearing. Now those words, cursing and swearing, require an object. So he calls a curse down upon himself if he's lying. You know, he said something like, "May fire from heaven descend on me if I'm not telling the truth." You know, something like that. Then did you note verse 73? "Surely you too are one of them, because the way you talk gives you away." Galileans spoke with a distinctive accent. And let me read about that accent in the Talmud. I got this out of the Talmudic anthology by Newman and Spitz. Got a good little resource to have. Erubim 53. The inhabitants of Galilee were careless in their pronunciation. Once a Galilean came to Judea and called out, "Who has Amar, an ass, for sale?" The Judeans laughed at him and answered, "Thou foolish Galilean, how are we to understand what thou wishest? Is it Hamar, ass, to ride on, Hemar, wine, to drink, Amar, wool, for a garment, or Immar, a sheep to slaughter. So he gets criticized because they can't figure out what he's saying. They take him to task for his Galilean accent. Well, Peter had that same accent, and so did the other disciples as well. Now, this cursing of himself alleviates the pressure of the accusations. Now, after the third denial, several things happen at the same time. Luke 22:60. But Peter said, "Man, I do not know what you're talking about." And immediately, while he was speaking, a rooster crowed. A rooster crowed. Now, here's a nice illustration of Peter shrinking away from his accusers, saying, I don't know the man. You know, may fire come down on me and strike me if I'm lying. And what is the artist painted into the picture? Well, there he is. There's our little rooster. The artist put him in the picture for Peter's benefit there. All right. When the cock crows, it's apparently the second time the cock crowed. Next, the second stage of the Sanhedrin trial before Caiaphas ended. The doors swing open. The eyes of Yeshua and Peter meet. Verse 61 and 62. The Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord and how he had told him, "Before a rooster crows today, you will deny me three times." And he went out and wept bitterly. So Peter remembers the prophecy. It flashes before his face and he goes out and he weeps in repentance. He goes out and he wept bitterly. Great. Sobbing, racking tears. Peter loved Yeshua. All right, Luke 22:63-65. Now the men who were holding Yeshua in custody were mocking him and beating him, and they blindfolded him and were asking him, saying, "Prophesy, who is the one who hit you?" And they were saying many other things against him, blaspheming. So this is a second mockery suffered of several mockeries that night. All right, lesson 13, page 43 in your outline, section 231, the third Jewish trial before the Sanhedrin. Now they try to legalize what has already happened and functioned as a kangaroo court. They're waiting for day to come so they can have a real quick trial and legalize everything. However, it's too late for that. Luke 22:66. When it was day, the council of elders and the people assembled, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council chamber, saying, so again, the Sanhedrin meets. And so they leave the Western Hill, and they go to the council chamber here. And we'll take a look at it now from the way it looks today. Here's the council chamber. Again, they go back down to the council chamber. Now let's pick it up on verse 67 through 69. "If you are the Messiah, tell us." But he said to them, "If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I ask a question, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God." So Yeshua says three things. First of all, they won't believe. He knows that. He knows where they're coming from. He knows they're just judging him. They're not looking for honest evidence. This is not a trial. Secondly, he knows the reason why they won't believe. They've decided not to believe. They've made up their mind. Slam the door on any other option. But thirdly, he says, "The proof of my words will come when you see me seated at the right hand of God. And then I will be judging you." All right, Luke 22:70. And they all said, "Are you the Son of God then?" And he said to them, "Yes, I am." And they said, "What further need do we have of testimony? For you've heard it yourselves from his own mouth." So the religious trial ends, and now we now move toward the civil trial. Now, although Yeshua is condemned to death, in 30 AD, the Jews did not have the authority to execute anyone. The authority was removed from the Sanhedrin by Rome. The authority for the death penalty, to execute the death penalty, was removed from the Sanhedrin by Rome. Now, they also need Judas for the civil trial, but they won't have him. Now, let's look at the Talmud here. Now, my source is the Sanchino Classics collection of the Sanchino Talmud. And here we read in Maaseh Sanhedrin 41, 40 years, that's A.D. 30, by the way, 40 years before the destruction of the temple in A.D. 30, the Sanhedrin was exiled, footnote 42, and took up residence in Hanut, footnote 43, and they did not try capital charges, footnote 45. Footnote 42. They were exiled from the Hall of Hewn Stones. Footnote 45. Hanut, a place on the Temple Mount outside the Hewn Chamber where they had temporary residence. And, footnote 45, capital charges could be tried only in the chief seat of the Sanhedrin, the Hall of Hewn Stones. And so, my note there, so the authority for capital punishment had been removed from the Sanhedrin. Now here is a floor plan of Herod's temple. This is the Hall of Hewn Stones. We know that very clearly. There's the Hall of Hewn Stones. And now this is a outside view of Herod's temple. This would be the Hall of Hewn Stones right there. Let's back out a little bit. Here's the Hall of Hewn Stones. And over here is an option for Hanut. Some people feel that Hanut is this location, the southeast corner of the royal portico. Now let's go down and stand underneath Solomon's portico. So we're under Solomon's portico now, looking to the south and the west. And what we're seeing is the eastern end of the royal portico. So we walk out from underneath Solomon's portico. There's the eastern end of the royal portico. Let's go on inside and see what it looks like. And there it is. This is a representation of what it looked like on the inside. Could this be where Yeshua was tried? It's possible that this is Hanut right here, but we really don't know. All right, let's think about some words of application. This is Lesson 13, page 44 in your outline. And the theme I chose was the proper and improper way to act. And the biblical material, in this study, time and time again, we see people doing things in an improper manner. One, the disciples providing improper prayer support for Yeshua in the garden. Two, Judas profaned the sacred when he betrayed Messiah at his arrest, kissing him over and over again. Thirdly, the arrest was improper at night. Fourthly, Peter's reaction to the arrest was improper when he drew his sword and whacked away at Malchus. Five, the trials were improperly conducted at night. And sixth, Peter profaned his relationship with the Lord by ending up denying him. All improper behavior. In contrast, Yeshua was the only person doing things in the proper manner that night. In his agony and submission to God's will, he endured it. He said, "Your will be done, not mine." Two, in his composure when arrested. You know, he is very calm and cool and collected. You know, I am he. And he forced them to the ground. Very calm, cool, and collected. But not overusing his divine power. Just using it enough to be a witness. Thirdly, Yeshua was proper in his conduct during the trials. Again, you'll see he's very dignified and forces them to consider their own laws and their own compromises. So let's talk personally. We cannot expect the world to act in a proper manner, but we can expect it of ourselves as believers. So let's put ourselves in Peter's place. First, when we're working for the Lord, shall we draw our sword and charge into the fray, charge into the battle in an improper manner? No, let's be very careful about that. Or will we choose to follow God's leading in our lives and make the decisions that affect the directions our life takes in the proper manner? That is, looking to Yeshua for guidance and direction. That's the proper manner to take on projects. Now, as we apply this lesson personally, let's look at two areas. Let's properly work for him. Will we work for him properly? And number two, will we witness for him properly? Will we do things his way and say the right words? So let's go on to a plan of action. Let's not quit right here. Let's go to a plan of action and write down something you could do to make this application, these comments, practical in your life today and in the days to come. All right, well, let's move on now to Lesson 14. This is still Session 46, But we're now moving into lesson 14. And page number one of your outline has the table of contents. It's part 12, the death of Messiah continued. That's your part 12 in the harmony, if you put the harmony. And we'll look at section 232 all the way down to section 237. That'll be lesson 14. All right, so we're in lesson 14, page 2, and we come to the remorse and the suicide of Judas Iscariot. So between the religious trial and the civil trial, Judas will die. Matthew 27:3. Then when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse. And he returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. But they said, well, what is that to us? See to that yourself. Okay. Now, some translations use the word repent instead of the word remorse. Now, there are two Greek words used for repentance. One is a noun that means to change your mind. That's salvation repentance. Metanoia, metanoia. This is not the word used here. And there's a verb that has a strong emphasis on the emotions. This is a metamelomai. It means remorse or regret. This is the word used in the case of Judas. Now, Dr. James Strong, in his exhaustive concordance of the Bible, compares these two words very, very nicely. He compares metamelomai and metanoia. Now, metamelomai, he says, refers to an emotional change. Emotional changes are up and down and up and down and up and down, yes and no. You can never trust emotions. But this refers to an emotional change of some sort, some emotional decision that could probably change in 2 seconds. Metanoia, however, refers to a change of choice. This is a change in the will, making a decision in your will that will probably not change. Metamelomai has reference to particulars, and Judas's particular was this one particular error, and that's turning Jesus over to the authorities for 30 pieces of silver, betraying him. That's the particular item that is so emotionally impacting Judas. Nothing else is being impacted in his life. Only this particular decision to betray Yeshua. Now, metamelomai has reference to the entire life. In other words, change your whole way of living, your whole outlook on life, your whole life perspective. That's the type of change metanoia refers to, your whole worldview. And then metamelomai signifies nothing but regret, even amounting to remorse. And metanoia, this is the fuller and nobler term, says James Strong. It's expressive of moral action and issues. And so it's metamelomai is the term used of Judas. Regret and remorse, but not biblical repentance. So, knowing Yeshua has been condemned at the religious trial, Judas is filled with remorse. He returns the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests. And he confesses, I have sinned, I betrayed innocent blood. He's guilt-ridden to the core. And they refuse to accept the money back. So Judas throws the money into the sanctuary and leaves. But note, his guilt is not diminished by his actions. Not diminished by his actions. Matthew 27:5. And he threw the pieces of silver into the temple sanctuary and departed. And he what? He went away and hanged himself. He committed suicide by hanging. Apparently, this is his response to the depression and the guilt that was bearing down on him. Now, this verse 5, seems to conflict with the Acts account, back Acts 1:18 and 19, which read, now this man, speaking of Judas, acquired a field with the price of his wickedness, and falling headlong, he burst open in the middle of it, and all his intestines gushed out. And it became known to all those who were living in Jerusalem, so that in their own language, the field was called Hakeldima, that is, the field of blood. All right, which is it? Did he hang himself? Or did he suffer some kind of a ruptured organs from a big fall or from a knife or something else? So is it hanged or ruptured organs? Which is it? Well, really, there's no conflict between the two. We simply have to go to Jewish law to understand what's going on. So I'll be harmonizing Matthew and Acts. This is lesson 14, page 3. And we'll just harmonize them by looking at Jewish law. All right, it's the first night of Passover. First night of Passover is finished. We're about to come to the first day of Passover when the morning Passover sacrifice would be offered. This is the Chagigah, the peace offering. Now the priesthood would partake, they would eat of this sacrifice, and they would do it before the sun set. However, according to Jewish law, if there's a dead body in Jerusalem, then the city is considered defiled. The morning sacrifice cannot be offered. Jewish law goes on to say that the body can be taken and cast into the valley of Hinnom. Then the city is considered cleansed, and the sacrifice can be made, and the sacrifice can be eaten. Later on, you can return and bury the body. Now, the valley of Hinnom was the garbage dump and a place of burning in Jerusalem. Here's first century Jerusalem. Here is the valley of Hinnom, curving around the west and southern end of the city. Valley of Hinnom. Now, I am in the lower right corner there where the X is. That's where I'm standing on the Mount of Olives, and I'm aiming my camera across the Kidron Valley to the juncture of the Kidron Valley and the Valley of Hinnom. This is the way it looks today. This is the way. Here is the Valley of Hinnom, curving around the south side of Jerusalem. You can't see it very well, but coming down from the north is the Kidron Valley. It's hidden by all the buildings in the way, but believe me, the valley is there. And so they meet together at this juncture. Now, the Hebrew for Hinnom reads Gay Hinnom, the Valley of Hinnom. And from that term, we get the term Gehenna. Now, with that background, we can harmonize Matthew and Acts accounts. Apparently, Judas hanged himself while he was still within the city walls. The city's now defiled for Passover. But the law says you can throw a body into the Valley of Hinnom, and so the city will be cleansed, and the morning sacrifice called the Chagigah can now be offered. Therefore, Judas's body, when it was discovered, was thrown down the steep cliffs in the Valley of Hinnom. And with that fall, when he hit bottom, the body split open and his intestines gushed out. And later they went in and buried him. Now, what about the 30 pieces of silver? Verse 6. The chief priest took the pieces of silver and said, "It's not lawful to put them into the temple treasury since it is the price of blood." Now, we can see rabbinic logic here. They recognize that the money was wrongfully gained. Oh, yes, Judas suggested the idea, but then again, they went ahead and paid for it. There's much a culprit in this as Judas was. Now, the price of blood was forbidden to be used by the temple treasury. So we're now lesson 14, page 4, at the top of the page of your outline. Let's look at the reaction, Matthew 27, 7 and 8. "And they conferred together, and with the money bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. For this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this day." So they bought the potter's field with the money. And this is thought to be the potter's field today, somewhere in this area here on the southern side of Jerusalem. Now, Acts 1:18 and 19 states that Judas, this man, bought the field with the reward of his iniquity, and that it was called the field of blood. Now, how did Judas obtain a field when in Matthew says the field was purchased by the high priest? So who purchases, Judah or the high priest? Well, again, the explanation becomes apparent when Jewish law is considered. So now we're at the heading Jewish law regarding the money. Now, by Jewish law, money that was wrongfully gained cannot be used for temple treasury. There are two options of what to do with the money. You can't put it in the temple treasuries, but you can return it to the owner. Well, they can't do that because Judas has committed suicide. And that's probably what Judas was trying to do when he threw the 30 pieces of silver into the temple. He was probably trying to return it to its owner because he knew it was blood money. Secondly, it could be used for the public good. Well, that's the only option available to them. Therefore, they purchase a field in the Valley of Hinnom for the purpose of burying strangers, and the first one is Judas. And the field had to be bought. It had to be bought in the name of Judas by Jewish law. So in that sense, Judas obtained the field. Now, another point of confusion is Matthew 27:9 and 10. We're at lesson 14, page 5 at the top. And we want to look at the significance of the Jeremiah quote. And this explanation comes in two parts. So let's look at Matthew 27, 9 and 10. Then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. And they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel, and they gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord directed me. All right, what's with the Jeremiah quote here? All right, part number one of the explanation. Matthew is using the name Jeremiah as a title for the prophets, as a generic title for the prophets. Now, from Encyclopedia Judaica, in the article about Jeremiah, we read that the prevalent Masoretic editions of the book of Jeremiah, in the prevalent Masoretic editions, the book of Jeremiah is placed after the book of Isaiah. All right, let me say that one more time. In the prevalent Masoretic text, the Masoretic editions, the book of Jeremiah is placed after the book of Isaiah. Now, this comment is a reference to the current Jewish canonical order of the latter prophets. The article then mentions an earlier arrangement of the books, not the prevalent Masoretic order. And here we go. According to an old order suggested by Bava Batra 14b and 15a, it was placed at the beginning of the latter prophets, before Ezekiel and Isaiah. In the old order, Jeremiah was placed first. Matthew is referring to this older order. It's as simple as that. Matthew is referring to the older order. And he's using an idiomatic expression that means what was spoken by the prophets. He's summing it all up. He's doing a summation. Now remember the four ways the New Testament uses the Old Testament in Dr. Fruchtenbaum's Messianic Bible study number 134. Remember that study way back in lesson 2, page 26. We saw the four interpretive techniques. The first rabbinic technique is the Peshat, a little prophecy plus a literal fulfillment. The second technique is the Remez, the allegorical or philosophical approach. That's a literal prophecy plus a typical fulfillment. The third one is the Drash, the agadic or homiletical or practical application. For us, it's a literal prophecy plus application. And we come to number four, the Sod, which is a mystical approach. And for us, that it would be a summation. That would be a summation. Okay, so he's using the term Jeremiah as an idiomatic expression for the prophets. And then he combines with that statement Zechariah 11, 12, and 13, and Jeremiah 7 and Jeremiah 19. Now, that's called rabbinic pearl stringing. That's a technique by the rabbis they called pearl stringing, taking individual verses and stringing them together like a beautiful set of pearls. So, this is the Jeremiah quote is a summary statement plus pearl stringing. A summary statement plus pearl stringing. Now, when Matthew mentions Jeremiah, the quotation in Jeremiah does not mention 30 pieces of silver. So here we go to explanation part 2 on Tophet. This is lesson 14, page 6 at the top. Now this is found in Zechariah 11:13. Then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price at which I was valued by them. So I took the 30 shekels of silver and threw them to the potter in the house of the Lord. So what does Jeremiah have to do with it? Well, there's various explanations. For the liberal unbeliever, they would just say, here's another proof against biblical interpretation. They didn't know what they were talking about. Just a mythical book. Now, secondly, the conservative Bible-believing theologian, would explain this as an error, a scribal error. Nothing wrong with the text, just some scribe messed up and put down the wrong name. Now, there's a better explanation if we understand the entire picture in the light of the coming AD 70 judgment. The explanation comes in Jeremiah 7, 30 through 34, and Jeremiah 19, 1 through 15. Now, the Valley of Hinnom extends from the western side to the southern side of the city, right there. It was used for human sacrifice by the kings of Judah. And from this we got the concept of Gehenna, the lake of fire, the burning of humans. Now in the days of Jeremiah, because of the sinfulness of Israel, Jeremiah was sent to the Valley of Hinnom to a specific section called Tophet. That's the Tophet section of the Valley of Hinnom right there. Now he pronounces a curse upon that section of the valley called the Valley of Slaughter. It'll be called the Valley of Slaughter. Jeremiah 7, 30 through 32. For the sons of Judah have done that which is evil in my sight, declares the Lord. They have set their detestable things in the house which is called by my name to defile it. They have built the high places of Tophet, which is in the valley of the sons of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I did not command, and it did not come into my mind. Therefore, behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when it will no longer be called Tophet, or the valley of the son of Hinnom, but the valley of the slaughter. And they will bury in Tophet because there is no other place. Therefore, behold, declares the Lord, this is in verse 19:6, days are coming, declares the Lord, when this place will no longer be called Tophet, or the valley of Ben-Hinnom, but rather the valley of slaughter. Now, the curse predicts that they shall bury and bury and bury in that valley until there's no more room for burying. Well, centuries later, the leaders of Israel used the 30 pieces of silver to purchase a specific place in the Valley of Hinnom, and so they purchased the very area of Tophet. And when they purchased it, they purchased the curse that went with it. And the curse was finally filled in 70 AD with a massive slaughter of the residents of Jerusalem by Roman armies who had been waiting for 2 years to break through the walls. As Jeremiah said, they slaughtered and slaughtered and slaughtered and slaughtered, and they buried and buried and buried and buried until finally there was a point where there's no more room in the Valley of Hinnom. It's not a mistake that Matthew mentions Jeremiah. Rather, he wants to indicate that what is happening is the purchase of the curse that went with the Valley of Hinnom in the area of Tophet. All right, now like the top of page 7, let's do a summary. Matthew's gospel is written in light of the AD 70 judgment. He wants to get that point across. Zechariah then mentions the price of the purchase, and Jeremiah dwelt on the concept of the curse that would come with it. So these verses are pearls strung together. All this done by pearl stringing. And so all of this comes together in understanding the nature of the unpardonable sin and the judgment of AD 70. The AD 70 judgment is a direct result of the unpardonable sin. All right, let's close by looking at Roman law, the top of page 8 in your outline. Now, in the religious trial, the issue was blasphemy, but in the Roman trial, the issue is going to be sedition. Sedition against Rome. Now, there's two things to note under the Roman trial. The proceedings had to be public, and so both times before Pilate, a multitude is there. Pilate has public hearings. And second, the proceedings had to be based on a specific charge by the prosecuting witness. And Judas is needed for this trial. He's needed as the prosecuting witness before Pilate, but in between the religious and civil trial, Judas committed suicide. Therefore, the trial does not go as smoothly as planned. All right, I'm a little bit over time here. I'm a little over time, so we'll pick it up next session in section 233, lesson 14, page 10, page 9 or 10 there, and we'll start the first Roman trial. We'll start with the first trials. There will be three phases of the Roman trials. I think you'll find it an amazing and encouraging and interesting section. Thanks so much for being us students. We'll see you next session. Lahitra Ot. Lahitra Ot.